House Finance come to order. It's 1:32 p.m. on February 27th, 2012. We have on our agenda today HCR 16, a constitutional amendment on education funding. It's our intent to listen to the sponsor, and there was one designated witness to help present the bill. It's our intent to take up public testimony in the next block of time tomorrow evening and get through as much of that as we can. We're going to have a presentation of House Bill 250, the co-chair's bill to extend the renewable energy grant fund, House Bill 224, sale of nicotine, Senate Bill 30, return of seized property, and House Bill 302. It's our intent to get through all of these. Some of these we're going to just hear and hold, but I wanted to really make an effort to get House Bill 224, Senate Bill 30, and House Bill 302 out of here. They've been friends here that we'd like to send on their way. We have President Representative Jewell, Representative T. Wilson, Vice Chair Fairclough, Stoltz, Co-Chair Thomas, Representative Dugan, Representative Edgman, Representative Guerra, and Representative Costello. So we'll invite Representative Keller to come forward, introduce your bill, and then tell us about the designated presenter to lay out some of the issues regarding this school choice that would be implemented by a constitutional amendment.
Thank you, Chair Stoltz, and thank you to the committee. We appreciate you hearing HGR 16. I'm Representative Wes Keller. I represent Wasilla, Alaska, and I'm the sponsor of HGR 16. We have expert testimony standing by. I will present my initial thoughts. Won't take long, but Richard Cummer works for the Institute of Justice, and he has been significant in several cases, including the landmark decision of Zelman versus Harris related to school scholarships and private education. HGR 16 is a step forward in the Alaska education system. I'm absolutely convinced of it. The purpose of the bill is to expand education choice options by allowing public money to follow the child based on the parent choice to private schools. It provides a legislative response to some Supreme Court decisions that have been made in the past that interprets very broadly the restriction of state money going into the private sector education. In those cases in specific, and I'm sure that Mr. Cummer will probably speak to them, but the cases are Matthews versus Quinlan and Sheldon Jackson versus the state of Alaska. Most of you are aware and have heard of those in the past. The Constitution has been interpreted by the Supreme Court simply to not permit funding to go to a private religious school, and you can see the language of the bill very simple and explicit. This game is to be some real exciting options out there, in the private sector. If you look at iTunes U, and Khan Academy, and they're just more and more available technology-wise, and frankly, we just this opens it up so that the private sector can be more directly involved if we take our money and invest in Alaskans. I'm doing this because Alaskans, I believe, really solidly support. I can say that subjectively from the number of calls and the number of people that have encouraged me in this bill, but also there was a really pretty credible survey that was done in September. If you go online and look for type in Blaine Amendment, because that is what we're up against. That's what it's called, the Blaine Amendment in Alaska.
The survey,
Blaine Amendment. Blaine Amendment. I could go into a long time explaining what the Blaine Amendment is. For now, just keep in mind that there's a survey out there, and it shows very solid support. It's a credible survey and a very solid support. It talked to me and my staff, and I can direct you to it and get you copies of it. 78 pages long. It's well done. Also, the AFM passed a resolution in support of school choice, specifically naming the resolution. I also want to say that Tom Fake, past Speaker of the House and Mayor of Anchorage, has worked tirelessly on this issue. He's online, not to make a presentation today, but he's online to answer questions. I just want you to know that if any questions come up. Charter schools have wait lists. Private schools are, even though they cost less, ultimately they're just simply prohibitive to many parents who pay our property taxes or, and then can't afford to pay the private school tuition on top, but even so, many do. 2.5% of the students in Alaska go to private school. Homeschool is not a viable option, of course, for many parents working. So we can look to the private sector for help with kids. It's a help in the situation would be very good. It's a big enough opportunity and issue anyway. And that's my summary statement here, to let the people of Alaska decide. The, keep in mind, this is a resolution. It's a resolution to get on the ballot in this November. Simple, in size anyway, amendment to the Constitution to allow for school choice, allow money to follow students into private schools. So with that, I will stop and defer to the expert testimony or your questions, you know, if you want any clarifications or
There is, and I wanted this to be the day where we're going to have a lot of time to answer questions. This will not pass out in one meeting or two meetings. This will be a bill. I want to have the public process follow the sponsor, the courtesy of laying out the bill. And they had one witness, and I thought that was in the realm of that was going to help present the bill. We have really one, with the Constitution Amendment, one immediate fiscal issue that's here for them because it has a the cost of printing an extra page in the ballot book. There are, certainly we can extrapolate how this would have other impacts of the budget, but we don't know until there's a bill or those are things that, but relevant to any discussion we have about moving a potential constitutional amendment out. But I want to hear from this witness and appreciate former Mayor Speaker Fink being online. But we'll just listen to this witness today and then have you do a wrap up and we'll set the bill aside for the public testimony. And This will not be advanced to move out of committee until we've had a robust conversation around this corner, around this little horseshoe as well. Representative Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out, Representative Keller, that AFN, Alaska Federation of Natives, has a resolution in the packet here supporting your amendment. I mean, that's huge. I was there with probably 5,000 Alaska Natives attending AFN. You know, it's probably one of the larger conventions. And just want to put on the record that they supported this. So.
Thank you, Co-Chair Thomas. It's very, very positive. And to me, I get really excited about some of the options. You know, if we open this up, I'm convinced that the Alaska AFN and other rural communities will come up with some real innovative stuff. I mean, there's really fun options out there. So, yeah, thank you.
I just want you to note, we have people that have signed up, but Mr. Alcantara from NEA Alaska, Ms. Joslin from Delta, Tom Fink, of course, we've already referenced those folks who, if they wish, will be at the, since they've already signed up, they can go and put them right at the top of the list, in addition to everybody else signed up or whenever they show up. So those folks, to let the folks that have, I thought we tried to be very clear in our committee description and announcements, but that said, everybody wants to testify. I understand that we will have, that was our intent to have in the evening to allow people that work for a living to be able to come out. We always hear from the government folks during the daytime or folks that don't have jobs. So, Representative Keller, continue and introduce your witness. Any other comments you have in laying it out?
Thank you. I wish that I knew Richard Dick. He serves as an attorney for the Institute of Justice, and just know him through correspondence and quick conversations on the phone. But he litigates school choice cases in federal and state court, and several of his current cases involve the constitutionality of allowing school choice programs to include religious schools among the private schools that can participate. He's a resident expert in Institute of Justice on Blaine Amendments, and he will probably give you some history of the Blaine Amendments, how it got the name, and whatever. I found it very, very fascinating. Prior to his work at the Institute, he worked as a civil rights lawyer for the federal government, and he also worked for the Department of Education and Justice, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and I will let him augment my introduction, if you will, when he comes on. Thank you.
Chair, do you have a question?
Representative Guerra.
Representative Keller, we can do the research unless you've already done it, but I'm curious. There is a whole volume of transcripts of the Constitutional Convention that reflect what the framers said about each of the provisions of the Constitution, including the provision that that currently bans public funds for private schools. And I'm wondering if you have compiled that portion of the transcripts. I mean, we'll do it if we have to, but we don't want to do it if you've already done it.
I've done it, but not in a way that is ready to be presented. But I found the history of the Constitution process to be just utterly fascinating. The Blaine Amendment was originally a federal attempt to amend the federal U.S. Constitution by Mr. Blaine, Congressman Blaine. He fell one vote short, so it didn't become part of the federal Constitution. But with all those votes, because he was only one vote short, they had options, legal options, just through congressional law, is where we all understand that process. So they passed laws that made it a requirement for any of the new states that became one of the members of the United States that included a Blaine Amendment. And so basically, all the Western states accumulated that that amendment, and some of the older states that had been in formation also picked it up. And since then, there's been several that have amended it. But I guess why I'm giving such a long answer is several of the states have very closely worded Blaine Amendments, like they say that no money should be directly or indirectly made available to the private schools. So any our constitutional amendments, like you say, there's volumes there, and they're in the context of that bit of history, and I don't have anything to leave beyond that.
Why don't you go ahead and so we stay on schedule, introduce your witness and Representative Dugan.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, to interrupt here, but I myself would like to know a little bit more about what the Institute of Justice is. So if the speaker could speak, the person that's going to present could speak to that, I'd appreciate it.
Sure, and that'd be good for the process. This was the only person the large group asked to help
represent. No, I have no problem with that.
Sure.
Chairman, I just
nope, that's good for the public process. So include that in your, if you don't, he will help edify us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will defer to him. He's online, I presume, listening, and I'm sure he will give us that information, but we'll follow up with whatever you want.
So,
Dick, are you online?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Go ahead and introduce yourself with that, maybe a description of your organization as well, the Institute for Justice.
Okie doke. Well, my name is Dick Homer. I'm a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice, and we're a public interest law firm located in Arlington, Virginia. We used to be in the District of Columbia that we moved out because it's cheaper in Virginia. We litigate in four different areas. Obviously, school choice is where I'm active, but we've also had cases at the Supreme Court involving our private property practice, particularly the Kelo eminent domain case that the Supreme Court decided a few years ago. We litigate in economic liberty, principally in efforts to open up entry-level occupations that are being over-regulated by state agencies. This involves things like African hair braiding or even in D.C. shoe shining provision. You name it, we've done it in that area. Restrictions on the sale of caskets for and requiring that all people selling caskets be licensed funeral directors, which takes 4 years and requires all sorts of things you don't really need to know. And First Amendment free speech issues. Mostly that has in recent years involved campaign finance reform laws. As Representative Keller mentioned, we've been involved in all of the school choice cases to date with very few exceptions, including two cases that we have participated all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court in, the biggest one being the 2002 decision in Zelman versus Simmons-Harris, which upheld the Cleveland Scholarship Program against the challenge first of a violation of the Ohio state constitution, and then in federal court a renewed challenge to it as violating the federal establishment clause. The most recent case we had was last year, which was the conclusion of approximately 12 years of litigation involving Arizona's tax credit for donations to private scholarship funds that then turn around and provide scholarships to individuals wishing to use private education. Both of those school choice cases were victories for us at the U.S. Supreme Court. And we've had three other cases there, but we did lose which involved eminent domain in New London, Connecticut. We've been in existence for about 20 years. We advise people who are trying to draft school choice legislation, as well as if it actually gets passed and it gets challenged, then we help defend it. Most school choice programs do get challenged by the teachers' unions and their allies, but most of our cases have been successful in defending. The state, of course, if it's passed, is the primary defendant, and we represent parents who intervene in the litigation to get their viewpoint before the court. And we've been involved with the Milwaukee program, which most people know, and which is the sort of paradigm for the urban programs that exist in Milwaukee, Cleveland, Washington, D.C., and New Orleans today. But there are other types of school choice programs that have been developed in the past 20 years. There's seven or eight that are specific to children with disabilities, and provide them with additional options for using private providers. Those have been frequently not challenged. Increasingly in states that have fairly bad law under their state Blaine amendments, we have encouraged, as in Arizona, the creation of school choice programs via private contributions that the state encourages through tax credit legislation. So those are some of the variety of things. There's now over 20 different school choice programs involving private schools. Obviously, there's many other school choice programs involving charter schools and public school choice, both of which we support, but we don't actually feel a need to litigate in those areas. This has resulted in us having developed quite a bit of expertise on state Blaine amendments, because the opponents of school choice programs would always prefer to strike something down under a state constitution rather than under the federal constitution, because they were from the beginning afraid that if we ever got this issue back in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, they would do what they in fact did, which is to uphold school choice programs as not violating the federal establishment clause as long as they are religiously neutral and as long as they do not encourage the use of religious schools over any other school. Those two components of it make it constitutional under the establishment clause. Blaine amendments are a peculiar development of the 1800s. What a new, relatively new state like Alaska lacks is sort of the long educational history of the lower 48. And the public schools were originally conceived and designed to be religious schools, but they were to be Protestant, generically Protestant. And they were never intended to reflect the ideology of any particular sect of Protestantism, but to be a generic Protestantism that would allow them to serve basically all Protestant school children. With the increasing number of Catholics coming to the United States, the same folks, the Protestant establishment, saw the public schools as a way of sort of weaning Catholics away from their Catholic faith and sort of encouraging them to become Protestants. And the Catholic Church, not surprisingly, resisted these efforts and resisted the required reading of the Protestant Bible in public school and the singing of Protestant hymns and the use of Protestant-oriented textbooks that basically derogated the Catholic faith. As a result, they requested an equal share of public education dollars directly for their public, for their private schools, for their parochial schools. And they were met first in the Know-Nothing movement of the 1850s and then later by the federal government itself, and particularly the Republican Party, with a rejection of those demands. And the result of that was, first in some state constitutions, like Massachusetts, language that is basically similar to what Alaska has in its constitution, which is language saying that no appropriation shall be made to any sectarian school. Sectarian was code for Catholic, and the Supreme Court, at least five justices of the U.S. Supreme Court currently have recognized that in various cases, that the Blaine Amendment, the federal Blaine Amendment, was in fact an anti-Catholic proposed enactment. Now, what happened was, in the 1870s, all Catholics were basically Democrats, Republicans, in an effort to sort of disenfranchise Democrats, proposed a federal constitutional amendment to make, basically, which would have required all states to abide by the language of these state constitutions like Massachusetts that said no appropriations for religious sectarian schools. And that failed to get the two-thirds majority required, but it failed by just a narrow margin in the Senate and passed overwhelmingly in the House, which meant that the backers had the votes to impose that through enabling legislation on any new states that came through the Senate and House Interior Committees seeking statehood status. So all states after the 1876 failure of the Blaine Amendment have Blaine Amendments in their state constitutions. Now, what's unusual about Alaska's constitution is it specifically says that no money shall be paid from public funds for the direct benefit of any religious or other private educational institution. That's narrower language than is typical, and that language is actually deliberate and is intended to distinguish between direct aid to religious schools as schools and indirect or incidental aid that benefits private school students. But does not go, I mean, and follows their choice of the private school. Now, this is a distinction which the Supreme Court of the United States accepted in Zelman in 2002, and I basically view House Joint Resolution number 16 as an effort to sort of bring the interpretation of your language, which is Article 7, Section 1, and related language in Article 9, Section 6 about public purpose. to bring that in line with the interpretation of the federal religion clauses. I would point out to you, because it has never really come up, but should have come up, that your Constitution actually has its own general religion clauses. This is at Article 1, Section 4, entitled Freedom of Religion, and is essentially a verbatim copy of the federal religion clauses from the First Amendment, and it says no law shall be made respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. I interpret that and the fairly limited language of your Blaine Amendment as an effort to sort of say, well, we in Alaska are going to use a standard similar to the federal Constitution. As you may know, the test for an establishment clause violation under the First Amendment is a three-part test, which is that a program shall neither have a purpose nor a fact of advancing nor inhibiting religion, in other words, religious neutrality, nor result in excessive entanglement of the state and religion. That's the three-part test from Lemon versus Kurtzman. And that's the sort of task that the language of this Article 1, Section 4 would suggest that the Alaska Supreme Court should apply when in addressing issues of a violation of establishment of religion principle. However, the reason you're considering this resolution is bad decisions by your state Supreme Court, because they have interpreted the language of these two provisions that are being proposed for amendment in House Joint Resolution Number 16, they've interpreted those very broadly. In fact, exactly the way that was rejected at your constitutional convention in 1955 and 56, where a movement was made to expand the language of your amendment to include direct and indirect benefit for any religious or private institution, and that was rejected. Yet when they have interpreted it in the two cases that Representative Keller referenced, which are Matthews versus Quinton and the Sheldon Jackson case, in both of those cases, they basically added indirect in and said, well, aid to students indirectly benefits the colleges or the, in particular, the elementary schools that they choose. Excuse me, Matthews versus Quinton was an elementary and secondary education case, and that's the first one, and Sheldon Jackson on that case. And in that decision, they basically said, if we provide aid to students to be transported to private religious schools, we're aiding the schools. Well, they might be aiding the schools in a very watered-down sense, but it's certainly indirect. And the understanding of the U.S. Supreme Court is that aid to students, and this is from Zelman, but also from a line of cases that led to Zelman, is you can aid students, and if they happen to choose a private religious school, that's not the same thing as providing a direct grant to a private religious school. They recognize the difference between incidental aid and direct aid. Direct aid can, in certain circumstances, run afoul of the Establishment Clause. But indirect aid to students is accepted, has been accepted for at least 10 years now in the K-12 context, and was never challenged in the secondary context. So the problem with Supreme Court decisions is that in our system of justice, the Supreme Court has the last word, absent a being overruled by the people or being overruled by a subsequent decision of the same state Supreme Court. In this particular situation, the proposal is to basically amend the language of these provisions to change the outcome with respect its Blaine Amendment, which they're one of the states that put in a Blaine Amendment without having to do so in order to become a state, because they're one of the original 13 states. But they adopted a Blaine Amendment towards the end of the 1800s, and then in 1936 interpreted it very restrictively to eliminate a student transportation program in New York State. Well, that's similar to what happened in Alaska in the Matthews versus Quinton case. Subsequently, in 1968, the New York Court of Appeals, which is their highest court, their Supreme Court, overruled itself and said, we got it wrong. Basically, our state constitutional provision, which says direct or indirect aid, in other words, it's broader than Alaska's language, isn't violated by student assistance programs because that's neither a direct aid or indirect aid. It's incidental aid, which is similar language to what the U.S. Supreme Court employed. When it's aid to students, any benefit to the schools they select is incidental to them having chosen it. So they overruled themselves. Similarly, South Carolina, which had similar language to New York in it, prohibited appropriations providing direct or indirect benefits to private religious schools. They struck down a higher education student assistance program on the basis of the indirect language, and then the legislature and subsequently the population through the initiative process removed the indirect language from the state constitution, and a new program of student assistance was enacted, which did not violate the remaining direct language of the Constitution. So that shows both a state that overruled, where the Supreme Court overrules itself, and another state where they take out language which has been, you know, viewed as prohibiting a beneficial program. So basically, I think that's, I've said enough. If you want to ask me any questions about how this all works, I'd be delighted to answer them, and we'll take it from there.
We'd like to invite you back in the wrap-up here. You're part of the sponsor's presentation. I wanted to first lay this bill out, and on the questions, Representative Keller, can you get us copies of those two state decisions? Would that be part of our packet? And members work through my office, and anything you want, we will request the sponsor to try to facilitate the discussion of this issue. So I'll give you a minute to close up, and we'll set this bill aside for the public testimony.
Okay. I think it's clear, but a wrap-up statement would be that the Alaska Supreme Court, through its decisions in the past, without value statement on those decisions, has allowed Alaska's Blaine Amendment to tie the hands of the legislature in enacting school choice reform initiatives, example being the one that jumps to mind is Sheldon Jackson, when we tried to, the legislature back then tried to assist the tuition of Sheldon Jackson, who no longer exists. Anyway, passage of this bill would allow Alaskans to decide whether to free our hands to do more to encourage school choice in Alaska. So thank you very much.
And make yourself available to committee members as well, Representative Keller?
Absolutely. Individually.
We will set this aside, and we will stand briefly at ease while the sponsor finishes preparing. We'll change spots here, and let's have Thomas and his staff up for House Bill 250. appointments come back to order. It's after a very actual brief at ease. I'll note that because they happen so seldom.
Not usually.
And the next bill up, Representative Thomas, is House Bill 250. Representative Thomas, why don't you introduce your legislative, make your comments, and we'll let your staff and the company take over.
I'm going to make them all, but I'm going to have Casey Schroeder-Hotch introduce the bill. It's, I have the same comments that she does here, so same sheet, so I'll let her speak. Well, and they'll follow up on the end.
I will not hold you back.
All right.
For the record, Casey Schroeder-Hodge, staff representative Thomas. House Bill 250 reauthorizes the Renewable Energy Grant Fund for another 5 years. The Renewable Energy Grant Fund was established in 2008 and since then has funded in the neighborhood of 200 projects across the state. At the end of 2011, 21 projects had fully come online due to the Renewable Energy Grant Fund. House Bill 250 also includes intent language to fund the program at $50 million a year, and that is a continuation of the intent language that was seen in the enacting legislation. And I would like to point out that we have Sarah Fisher Goad and Peter Krim from AEA here, and they are the experts on the program, and they can answer any of the program-specific questions that the committee might have.
It's not Emily Wood here.
I'm just trying to catch my breath over here.
Now, I know Ms. Hotch's enthusiasm would be only equaled by her boss.
Are you done? I just want to point out, if I can, Mr. Chairman, point out that the money that was brought in by HB 250 by the state was also brought in $100 million federal funds, matching funds, so that has helped a lot. And I'm going to use one community that where we used some of this money and some general funds to retire some debt, took their costs, I think it was like 80 cents down to 22 cents once the hydro got online. It's making a significant difference out there in the community. And I think the main also point, I think you pointed out, is the displacement of the diesel. And it's huge, and it's just going to be more and more diesel displaced and renewable energy out there. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Or co-chair.
Thank you. General comments, Ms. Goad and Mr. Grimm?
For the record, Sarah Fisher Goad, Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. We're really here to answer the questions on the program and any issues that the committee has with respect to our management of the program for the last few years.
I don't, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, we have these folks here, Representative Dugan and then Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. EC said that it was $50 million a year, which, as everybody knows, except for the first year when it was $100 million, it's been $25 million, I think, right? Thank you. Can you sort of explain what happened there and why we would authorize this for a number that we haven't been reaching since it started?
Through the Chair, Representative Dugan, that was just a continuation of the intent language that was in there. It's intent language, the legislature can do or change it, or do whatever they want.
Excuse me if I might. So basically, this is just a replay of what we've already had.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Reaching for the stars every time, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
And knowing that you don't always get there?
Oh, you do have the power of appropriation. We ask for X number of dollars and get so much, so.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, but I think you have the power of appropriation.
How about we?
The Constitution says the legislature.
Yep.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the legislation. I'm signed on as a co-sponsor. And it's hard to imagine that we're already back trying to reauthorize this program. It seems like it was just yesterday. I think that was 2007 or 2008 when this was authorized. I remember the debate very well. I just want, in terms of offering my support for the bill as well, for the record, to clearly reflect, however, that this shouldn't be, I think Senator Murkowski referred to it during her address, the joint session a couple of days ago, last week, that this program, although successful and certainly I think poised to do a lot more good work, shouldn't be considered as the sort of the panacea for the energy situation in Alaska. Because were that to be the case, and I think we could all agree, we wouldn't have gone into special session last year with $300 million-plus in projects, really being a bone of contention between the House and the Senate. So this program, you know, it was launched back, I think it was passed in 2008. The way I interpreted it was to be kind of larger in scope. But where it is today, and I think it's been an effective program, and I laud the Alaska Energy Authority for the work they've done with the program, it's far more narrow in scope in terms of what it does for renewable energy projects. And the track record, I think, has been successful in some areas, but if you take out a couple of big projects, the success is really kind of mixed around the state, more around the margin in terms of smaller wind projects or smaller biomass projects. So I want to be really clear that although I'm a strong supporter of the bill at the same time, I don't leave any misimpressions out there that for me as a rural legislator that this, you know, is largely going to be the vehicle that's going to tackle our energy issues out there, because it is to some extent, but to a larger extent, there's just a lot of areas out there that don't have renewable energy options. Flat out don't have it. This program will not impact them. So that's probably a pretty confusing statement to some, but I just want to be real clear that that I think this program should be recognized for what it is and what it isn't. Thank you.
Mr. Thomas.
Thank you. I just responded when I think it was my first year we introduced this bill, and because it had nuclear in it, didn't get it out of the first committee, so the next time we came around, we struck that out.
It was radioactive?
Yes. and so we took that out, and we went forward. And I want to also point out that Sarah Fisher Goad was a staffer at the time, and about drove her and Casey crazy getting this bill passed originally. I want to just point out, Mr. Co-Chair, that at the time, renewable was more like a hippie word around here. It was never seen to be, you know, something that was, you know, that we looked more as little things you put on your building or something. And so this was somewhat of a big leap forward to do hydro and wind energy and the whole definition to it. After that, it was pretty common for people to use the word and was kind of groundbreaking, and it did stress us all out when this thing was moving very slowly. And I, just for the credit, and some people may not realize it, but this bill was stuck in Senate Finance, and then when Governor Sarah Palin said, I want that bill, it did pop out of the Finance Committee in the Senate with an appropriation. Before, it was just a bill recognizing the program. And she wanted $200 million, and I believe the Senate put $250 in it, if I remember right, and got out of those. So,
Mr. Minister. Yes, to follow up on Representative Thompson's comments, and what I remember back from that era, just 3 or 4 years ago, was that to many, renewable energy was interchangeable with cheaper energy. When in fact, we have since then learned that a lot of times renewable energy is, in fact, more expensive or doesn't promote affordable energy, not always, but in some cases it does. And if the chair is willing, I'd like to hear the Alaska Energy Authority maybe talk a little bit about that renewable energy sometimes, although attainable, it doesn't really lead us to affordable energy.
Well, like a wind project that works in Kodiak, but it's kind of a dismal failure on potential costs in Anchorage, that type of thing.
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Ms. Gillard?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there was an earlier request that came through House Finance that we've provided a chart on projects that we have a one-year worth of data that we've collected that is showing the payback period for several of the projects. And I guess I maybe would characterize Representative Edgman's comments slightly differently, but I think it is important to recognize that there are fuel cost savings that maybe in today's dollars may not be necessarily comparable or particularly cheaper, but the expectations is fuel costs will continue to rise pretty significantly for the next 20 years. And so the expectation is that you are trading the import of fuel to communities, and especially in rural Alaska, and trading it with projects that are using local resources for that generation. So you're stabilizing the fuel costs. That's one of the theories on moving towards the renewables. But With respect to Representative Edmonds' other comments, which are very true, is that not all communities have renewable resources that are available to be developed. We are looking at certain challenges and, I believe, opportunities with respect to the program where, through our rural energy planning process that we are developing beyond the rail belt plan that we've worked on and also the Southeast Integrated Resource Plan that we are continuing to work on. We are looking at a real kind of community-wide and region-wide approach to plan for energy, where we need to start with a good rural power system and a powerhouse system in order to be able to successfully integrate wind into these smaller systems. So I think there is value and benefit to that, but there is still a lot of work to be done on that, and also project development. That's something that we've been working on making sure that there is the appropriate technical assistance for a lot of these projects to move forward. So with that, I think there are certainly learning moments that we've had with respect to the program, and I think, you know, there are benefits that are showing. We are showing a good diesel displacement metric with the projects, and again, there's a lot of work to be done, but we have right now 14 projects that have one full year of data. And Peter can run through, I think, some of the projects that we have that are showing where there isn't maybe the payback in 2011 field costs, but we are starting to see some very good results.
All right, Mr. Chairman. I just want to jump back in, and maybe I mischaracterized my statements about renewable energy not necessarily being, in some cases, more affordable. I think it should be noted, Representative Thomas, you sit on the Energy Advisory Committee that actually guides the Energy Authority in terms of their selection of these projects as they move forward. So there's a probably longer list of projects than the shorter list that actually gets to the funding stage, or that actually gets to the point where the legislature funds these projects. So part of my statement was that a lot of projects come forward, you know, that are renewable energy in nature, but don't meet they don't make the cut. For whatever reason, and some of them is probably affordability or the ability to fit into the grid and actually provide sort of more cheaper rates. So that was part of where I was going with that comment, and I wasn't, you know, insinuating that the Energy Authority approves renewable energy projects that aren't, you know, beneficial to the consumers. I want to be clear about that.
If we could figure out how to get BTUs out of warm green feelings, we could really affect some change, because some of these are social decisions that we're making, not really energy decisions. So Representative Fairclough and then Guttenberg, and we'll come back to Mr. Crimp after with that line.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask first about the 21 projects, but it might be better of the 14 projects that we have good data on. Can you tell me whether the kilowatts produced met expectations and whether they're geographically spread through the state?
If I may, Peter Crimp, Deputy Director of Alternative Energy and Energy Efficiency. Generally speaking, the projects are fairly, the 14 projects for which we provided operational data are fairly spread throughout the state from Southeast Hydro and Interior, more in the biomass, South Central also, and wind out in the western part of the state or southwest. In terms of, I'm not sure if I understood your question, but that was my first shot at it, Richard.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I asked what was the expected kilowatts that would be produced and whether the projects were meeting those expectations.
I see. Through the chair, Representative Senator Fairclough, we're at.
I'll second that.
I'm sorry. Senator, I'm sorry.
I'll proceed in order, sir.
At this point, the actual against the goal. And I haven't broken them out by kilowatt hours for the heat versus the power projects, but we're at about 84% of the goal for the projects that we assess performance information for 2011.
Thank you. Slightly under. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you tell me, as we're going forward, are we looking to partners, and are those partners federal partners or private sector partners?
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, we are always looking for matches a significant weight that we have for evaluating a project where we can partner with the federal agencies. And the Denali Commission is still very active with respect to our programs. I think that is still a funding source that grantees look for. And, of course, independent power producers are also eligible applicants to the program, so any additional private sector investment in the projects are, of course, welcome. And there's also been growing discussion with respect to developing a loan program to go with projects. But we do have the Power Project Fund loan program that is available for entities to borrow and help meet a match to score higher with match, and then also have that other funding available to them.
Mr. Chairman, just finally, I don't sit on the board, and so the one time that I have an opportunity to hear a little bit more definitively about what's going on is when you have a request before finance. So are we making sure that regionally we're looking at power generation so that inside of regions they can come together with plans and transmission proposals so that we can provide sustainable and hopefully affordable energy into local communities? Are we regionally looking at the state and trying to make sure that there are beneficiaries in different parts of the state just as far as the award process goes? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, I think actually this has been a good the Renewable Energy Fund program has been a very good tool to help kind of focus those issues, and it's dovetails very nicely into our regional planning approach, and we have been building upon the pathway document that was published by the Alaska Energy Authority last year, and we are moving towards regional planning. Sandra Moeller, the Deputy Director of Rural Energy, has been heading up those efforts. We have a contract with for the Chulista region with Navista Light and Power to kind of spearhead that approach. What we've done differently than our larger integrated resource plans for Southeast and for the Rail Belt is really look for a local or a regional entity that can really kind of do most of the coordination and take some of that we would help fund them to take on that role, but we would provide more of a technical resource and support for the that regional development. And, of course, any type of transmission system and any type of interconnection for particular communities, that's where all of those issues should be coming together for having any type of a mini system for, like a smaller transmission system between communities.
Yeah, the fellow in the front row with the iPad is just, why don't you shut it off or leave the room? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A statement and then a question. We live in interesting times. In the 70s, it was Stuart Brand and the Whole Earth Catalog, and it was all the alternative ways of coming up with power. Then it was how to get off the grid. Now Mr. Brand says his mistake was not supporting nuclear back then, looking where we are now in this world. Representative Jewell one time illustrated how coal in a lot of villages would be a very reliable alternative energy source for a lot of people versus diesel and all the different ways it has to get it into town. My comment was, my question was, this Alaska Power Authority paper that we have here says that at the end of 2013, the displacement of fuel displacement was 3.4 million gallons or equivalent. And by the end of 2016, displacement will be 11.6. Well, that's a tripling of the savings, the displacement savings. And if we triple that again in 3 years and triple that again in 3 years. Pretty soon we won't be on oil at all. But do you have a chart showing the displacement by these products of diesel over a period of time and what you expect to, if you expect to keep the savings up, or how you expect to get there?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Gunberg, we did provide a disc, a CD, to all the members of the legislature that included a program status report. And within that, we gave the detailed energy production of the projects for 2011 and 10 and 9. We do have in that a bar chart that projects fuel displacement based on rounds 1 through 4.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, and going out into
questions, not speeches so much.
Yeah, and going out into history, do you have what it would take to keep that chart going?
Well, through the chair, Representative, we have projected, just based on the projects that have been funded to date, once round five, if and when funds are appropriated for round five, then we will add that to the chart, and it'll, of course, increase the projected displacement. But it is based on the funded projects.
Okay, that's fine for that.
Thank you, Representative Guerra.
Thank you. A couple questions. You know, sometimes the economies of scale for, let's say, wind power projects are better if you have more turbines. But those turbines might not be exactly located in one village. It might be that you could have a large wind farm that would transmit energy to a number of villages, and that would be the most efficient way possible to do that. Does the current wording of the Renewable Energy Fund allow us to pay for transmission that will make for a more efficient renewable energy project?
Through the chair, yes. Transmission lines that connect to a renewable resource is an eligible project.
Thank you.
Can you hear your second question?
There are multiple benefits of having locally trained people to work on renewable energy projects, to maintain them, to keep them running, to repair them. Does AEA have any program, or has AEA coordinated with anybody to sort of maximize the ability of us to have sort of local people work on these projects to maintain and repair them?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, we have a training program that includes hydro training, and also we've been expanding to include the development of training on wind diesel systems. And so we also have technical assistance to work with the local powerhouse operators with the integration of the diesel systems. So yes, we do have a training program that is able to address that. Thank you.
Thank you. And then just finally, Mr. Chair, I don't mean to get into an argument here. It's just we have a difference of opinion on this. But, Mr. Krimp, let me ask you this. In Anchorage, we have our wind power project. Many people wanted it to be larger, but it could not be larger if the city didn't participate in buying power. If the city did participate in buying power, it's my understanding that the cost of the wind energy produced at Fire Island would have been lower. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I don't have enough information to answer that.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I may add on that that the Alaska Energy Authority is working with Chugach Electric Association and also the other railroad utilities, including Golden Valley Electric Association, on working on a regulation wind study to help integrate the Eva Creek project and also the Fire Island project into the system. So I think some of that work will help any future further developments of wind projects in the rail belt system and potentially the expansion of that project, although I don't know what the current plans are of the project proponents.
Thanks. Just finally, through the chair, I would advocate to the extent AEA is able to help expand that project. I certainly appreciate it.
And I would also want AEA and the RCA to make sure that the consumers of MEA, which are a helpless customer, don't get tagged onto an expensive project that
potentially hamstring my consumers. Again, there is no warmth in a green feeling.
Mr. Chairman, that was the intent of us participating in the regulation study is to help address those issues.
That's it. I'm not going to get in a battle of sound bites. We'll stop it there.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you were mentioning the wind projects, is there a reason that Delta is being left out of the study?
Through the chair, I the Eva Creek and the Fire Island projects were the larger projects. I guess the Delta project, I believe, is integrated into the system. It's much smaller amount of power right now. So I guess it's not that it's not. It's not that it's not included, it's that it's not the larger project coming online.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
They're not larger because they could get bought into GBA, and I would be very curious whether or not all the studies they have done and have learned along the way that should be able to be utilized, especially since we have new ones coming. So it could be larger if just their hands were kind of tied.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that again is the intent of the regulation study is to help kind of put some guidance with respect to how larger wind systems could be integrated into the rail belt system.
Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Just a comment.
We'll let you close. Co-chair.
Let me close. Thank you. I just want to point out that the community of Metlakatla's hydro turned 100 years old here a couple years ago. I think it was the first one built in Alaska. And so it's not like they wear out. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been into a hydro not a hydro plant, but you can't even hear that thing moving. And you sit there and you watch it, and this thing is spinning, making electricity. It's just so quiet. I just want to point out that once they're built, they're going to last for a long, long time. And I don't know what about how the wind energy works, but I've been going to Palm Springs for 20 years, and these keep spinning out there for some reason. So anyway, Mr. Co-chair, I'd like to, when we bring it back up, I'd like to see it move, because this is does have some help in it. It's helping in throughout the state because it's got a regional balance of funding. And it's something that the board, which I sit on along with Senator Hoffman, made sure that we had regional balance and expenditures so that one district didn't take it all. And also point out to them that there is a capital process through CAPSIS that you can enter in and help your region. And one more quick comment, and it'll be done, is that we didn't realize this until we talked to AEA's consultant about why we were a little more further along in some projects than other regions. But we put a energy consultant at Southeast, Anyway, we put a person in down there for energy assistance, and he's helping the communities as they go along. And it was the ARDRs. So if you have ARDRs, we told this person, well, find somebody in your ARDRs to help you. Southeast Conference, there we go. And so we have that person there, and every once in a while we wonder if we're going to keep him because I think AEA looks at him too much because he does a good job down there, so. Anyway, you know, those of you who do have an ARDR in your district, you might want to make sure that you have somebody that's there that's capable of chasing the dollars around and helping them, you know, on some of these projects. So, thank you, Mr.
Chair. Second, use the ARDRs, endorse the ARDRs, embrace the ARDRs.
That was one of my first bills that I get was here in my head. I was a mighty co-chair of Commerce, CNRA. And we passed that major bill.
That's
right?
A launching pad for a lot of great
Kevin Meyer was here.
Mr. Halprow.
Yep. Thank you. Thank you for hearing the bill.
We will set this aside, and anybody that was signed up, we wanted to have all the public testimony. Staff will notify. I think these folks are pretty aware of the process, but for practice, anybody that was signed up, we will notify them when the bill comes up again. And we will hope to actually post it is our intent so that people know it's, although the rules allow it to just come up, we want to make sure there's plenty of awareness. I'm just going to skip the Schedule 1 item. Fred, Senator Dyson has been in here for a couple of days waiting for his bill. And I want to bring up Senate Bill 30. And, We will stand at ease for about 30 seconds to let Senator Dyson come up. We have Senate Bill 30, Return of Seized Property, sponsored by my neighbor and colleague, Senator Dyson. Presenting today will be a member of our committee, Representative Wilson, and Mr. Kopp from Senator Dyson's staff.
Ready? Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Tammy Wilson. I represent District 11, and I'm very honored to be carrying Senate Bill 30, which is all about justice. When a victim of a crime has had their property held as evidence by law enforcement agencies, it could be months or even years before they are able to have their possessions returned. By holding a victim's property as evidence for a prolonged period of time, extra burden is placed on the property owner to replace what has been taken as evidence. The consequences are even higher for small business owners who may face bankruptcy if their property loss is a crucial component of their daily operations. Senate Bill 30 will introduce a process for victims of property crime to petition the court for relief and recovering their property as held as evidence. With me to provide further information on SB 30 is Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Dyson, and online we have Victor Kessler, the Executive Director of the Alaska Office of Victim Rights. And I just want to make sure people know that this is about a process, so we're not changing anything except making a process so that people can get their things back a lot quicker than what currently exists. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if you would like, I can go through the sectional analysis.
You can gauge, I think there's a lot of support for this, but it's good for the public record. Why don't you, I don't think we need to go line by line, but why don't you just
brief summary,
the basic elements, and I think even just put a little more of the problem on the record.
Okay, yes, sir. Just to state the issue, in the law now, the process is discretionary for return of property at the level of the advocate, the attorneys involved. If those advocates don't agree, it can be quite a long period of time before crime victims are able to have the opportunity for their property to be returned. Often crime victims are businesses who, having their property confiscated as a result of a case, are unable to consummate a sale, or they're underinsured on the property, and it can be very problematic. There are letters of support in the packet from business owners that talk about how painful that is when that occurs. This makes a neutral decision maker, and the court gives them the opportunity to weigh in on those decisions, and it gives the right of a crime victim direct access to court to say, Judge, I'm told I can't get my property back. Can you decide if my interest in having it returned outweighs that of the other parties? So briefly getting into it, Section 1 states that a crime victim who is the owner of property in the custody of a law enforcement agency may request the agency for the return of their property through the Office of Victims' Rights. The Office of Victims' Rights will file a request with the agency after conducting an investigation to make an initial determination if the crime victim is entitled to the return of the property being claimed under the proposed requirements of 1236-070C, which briefly are that the crime victim provides satisfactory proof of ownership of the property, the party that's objecting states the reason for their objection, and the party that's objecting to the return of the property fails to prove that the property must be retained by the agency for evidentiary purposes. Once the Office of Victims' Rights makes a predetermination, they will request on behalf of the crime victim that the agency return the property. Within 10 days after receipt of a request and following reasonable notice to prosecution, defense, and other interested parties, the agency will request a hearing before the court to determine if the property shall be released to the crime victim. The court of jurisdiction is identified in cases involving the pending criminal case and in situations where no criminal case is pending. It establishes that the burden of proof to be used is a preponderance of the evidence for both the crime victim showing ownership and the objecting party proving the property must be retained by the agency. It establishes that if the court orders the return of the property to the crime victim, the court may impose reasonable conditions on the return to maintain the evidentiary integrity of the property. And it identifies the term crime victim as having the meaning given to victim in AS 1255-185 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. Section 2 establishes within Title 24, Chapter 65, Office of Victims' Rights, the authority of the Office of Victims' Rights to request a law enforcement agency for return of the property on behalf of the crime victim claiming property after conducting an investigation as prescribed in AS 1236-070C, and it provides that the victim's advocate may use any of the powers granted to the advocate under Title 24, Chapter 65. Thank you.
Thank you. And for the record, that was Mr. Kopp, who is the Chief of Staff for Senator Fred Dyson. For those of you, Mr. President, new at this game. Any questions for the Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like you've got all of the lawyers in the other body signed on board. Number two on page two in the middle on line 11. I mean, certainly providing evidence of ownership goes without question. But it seems like number two, it gets complex. I mean, I'm very supportive of getting stuff back, you know, the agency. But what is the preponderance of evidence in a case, in a situation like this? I mean, you have an agency where you're public safety, you might have other agencies involved in something, and you have a defense lawyer, or could have a defense lawyer. Certainly, if the case is run its course, and there should be no problem. But somebody wants something back sooner, or there's a challenge to it. And if there is a lien or a judgment against somebody, what happens to that in that case? And there's property that they want back. They file for it, but somebody else has a judgment on it.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Gutenberg, those are good questions. On line 7, we note that the court may order the return. The language is permissive. There are always possibilities that are numerous, that in intricacies in contested claims that the court could rule on. Also, the reason why the preponderance of the evidence, that was a standard recommended by the Department of Law. It's more probable than not that a party deserves to have its property back, more so than the state or defense or another interested party is claiming that it should be retained in the custody. And the court can determine that based on the provisions of this chapter or any other law that would dictate when property can be released and when it can't be. And then also on lines 14 and 15, of course, the key language is if the court orders the return of the property, then it may impose reasonable conditions on the return. And that was just for those situations where you might have situations that are the property may be needed back soon. As evidence, it may be needed kept in a certain condition, may not be sold. But what can happen with a piece of heavy equipment, like a bobcat or backhoe or something where you've got an ongoing job, and maybe it was stolen or it was used to commit another crime and the business owner would like it back right away to continue business, it allows the court to weigh in and say, I believe this can be properly photographed and documented, and Mr. Business Owner, we're going to ask you not to sell it or do anything else, but you can have it back to complete your job. And the language we feel is permissive and broad enough to allow the court the discretionary authority it needs in those situations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Thomas, and then Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Your comment kind of dabbled a little bit. I see a letter here from Hal Ingalls where a vehicle of his was confiscated and some equipment. You know, those who have been in the industry know that when you run a machine and the hydraulic hoses, Senator Dyson and I are fishermen, if you use them, it's when you shut the, and it's not being used, is when you have deterioration. And I know that Alaska's porcupine love tires. So what happens where, if let's say Mr. Ingalls' vehicle was part of an accident 13 months ago, and you go back there, you have to replace the hydraulic hoses, the porcupine ate the wheels. I mean, I've had friends who had a property confiscated by the state, took 3 years to get it back, and they just said, so what? At least he got it back. But the tires were shot because they sat there too long and everything fell apart in the vehicle. So does this require that the state return it back in a condition? Was that, maybe I didn't read your, I think your sectional reasonable.
Through the chair, Representative Thomas, it doesn't guarantee the condition that you get the property back. What it does is it just provides crime victims an avenue to directly appeal to the court when they are faced with those situations where they cannot get parties to agree to release the property to them. So those variables can still come into play as far as.
In your Section 1, Line 7, and your sectional establishes that if court orders the return of the property to the crime victim, the court may impose reasonable conditions on the return to maintain the, you know, the integrity of the property. Right. Seems like the court would say, give it back, you know, kind of the condition. Especially if you're, from what I see from looking at Mr. Engel's property, was kind of innocent, and somebody, you know, seemed like they would make sure that that piece of equipment and the car is, and, I mean, why get it and have four flat tires or something? But anyway.
I think one thing we're missing is we're trying to improve what's already a pretty bad situation, and you've had to claw your way through a whole group of lawyers, as has already been referenced, and the court system, and all the defense bar. A lot of times the defense attorney will string along the owner of the property and make it very difficult, make them want to drop the case to get their property back, and that's kind of legal extortion, and this is just one little bit of reach of the property victims' rights here, and it's we get there incrementally. I would like to have it a lot different, and I know it took you a lot of work to get to this, and if I could do more here, I know it's been a tenuous balance of what you've been able to get. This is victims' rights has been, unfortunately, an incremental, and then I think it is with this, if we get one more avenue where a property owner can get there, whether it's a construction job that's halted because there's stolen tools and equipment, or the livelihood of a craftsman. I mean, these are just some of the things you're talking about. And one of the people that was referenced in a letter, it was said, thank God they were a bigger company. If you just have one vehicle, you can't shock absorb a loss of losing your only working vehicle or your only set of tools. I've heard anecdotal from people in the trade unions. You just go down and you just take the loss. You either move on and say, we can't make through the legal system. But I don't want to beat up on you because your effort, you've gotten this as farther than I've seen it. So we all have this hope for a perfect bill. This isn't a perfect process around here.
I very much appreciate those remarks, Chair. It has taken 3 years to get here. So.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to refer the committee to three letters that we have and put it on the record. We have a letter in support of SB 30 from the Alaska State Home Builders Association. We have a letter from the National Federation of Independent Businesses. Both letters are citing fighting the government who has endless resources versus a smaller business who doesn't. Mr. Chairman, if I could have the privilege, I would like to read into the record the short paragraph. It's been 14 months now, even though the letter says 13. Since the accident, with no police report or indication that we may be able to get our equipment back anytime soon, nor are we able to make a settlement with our insurance company. If we were a smaller business than we would be out of business by not having access to our equipment to continue to operate. Renting equipment to replace what is impounded until the case is settled would be a financial burden we would have to incur until the troopers complete their paperwork. Mr. Chairman, I just point out, as has been said by others, that it's hard to fight the government, and this is a process to help an individual when there isn't harm to acquire their personal property back. And then to the co-chairman's issue, if we do hang on to property and that property is destroyed during its possession, it seems like there is recourse, and this process will actually help the state with that recourse. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Costello, I hadn't forgotten about you earlier.
Thank you, through the chair. I just wanted to ask about Mr. Engel's situation and whether or not the effective date on this legislation would actually be of any help to him, or if it's simply for people who, as we move forward, find themselves in his unfortunate situation.
Through the chair, when the law becomes effective, the avenue becomes available to him.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I just did want to thank the sponsors of this legislation. I think it's really important, and it's unfortunate that it didn't come around sooner. So I've actually signed on as a co-sponsor after this hearing. Thank you.
Thank you. We have a couple of people to testify. We have Andrew Walker from Soldotna. I want to get through the public testimony on this. I think you have a pretty supportive committee, but I want you to be able to put your issues on the public record, Mr. Walker, if you're still there.
Yes, how are you doing? Thanks for hearing me, and thanks for your time. I'm the owner of Computer Renaissance down here.
Please just identify yourself. We have a public record. We have to keep the testimony ready.
My name is Andrew Walker, and I am the owner of Computer Renaissance here in Soldotna, Alaska.
And proceed with your testimony. Just book formalities if you go through here.
I understand. Back in September of 2010, we were defrauded out of a laptop by way of a bad check or a fraudulent check. There were three different people involved in the fraud. There were two ladies that were actually picking up the merchandise and then a gentleman that was doing the forged checks. And since then, our laptop, which we were defrauded out of, which was a fairly high-end laptop at the time, it was $1,100, has been sitting in police lockup because they could not release it to us until everyone involved in the case had been tried. I did finally get my laptop back last week, but as in the technology world, everything has a fairly rapid depreciation in value. By the time I got the laptop back, it was worth less than half of what it was the time it was stolen from me. And what's funny is they recovered the laptop from him about 4 or 5 days after we'd been defrauded out of it. And so since then, it has been in police lockup. It was also damaged in police lockup, just cosmetic damage, scratches and things like that. They also lost the power cord for it. So by the time I got it back, you know, in addition to depreciating at least half its value, I also had to replace a few things in it. I tried to get them to take the hard drive out of it, which was the only thing that would have evidence in it, and just give me the laptop back quite a while ago so I could just put a new hard drive in, sell it, and I wouldn't be out quite so much money. But the bottom line is, because of the slow process and a laptop that they had for such little time, there was no evidence on it that would have convicted them. And now, as a business owner, I am out all of that money, not because of the people that stole it from me, but because of the court system and the delays associated with that. So it would have been very helpful if I had had an avenue to appeal to get my property back, whereas now there is no such avenue that a victim can take to get his property. So that's pretty much it. You guys have any questions for me, or?
Questions for Mr. Walker? Thanks for sitting through this part of the process. You've had a lot of fruitless government processes. I hope this one has a better result for you, sir.
You know, it's fine. Anything that I can do to help, you know, victims of crime get their stuff back in an expedient manner, especially, you know, businesses and people that rely on that, I'm happy to be part of it. Thanks for listening to me.
Thank you, sir. Next, Mr. Kester.
Good afternoon. My name is Victor Kester. I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights, a legislative agency that represents crime victims in court and furthers their interests in accord with Alaska law and ethics. It is a privilege and honor to testify before the committee today. Honorable Chair and honorable members of the House Finance Committee, I hereby submit my enthusiastic support for Senate Bill 30. I believe the bill provides a valuable tool for crime victims to attain return of their property held during the course of a criminal prosecution. I think there are several positive aspects about Senate Bill 30 I would like to briefly outline today. First, Senate Bill 30 provides a balanced means for crime victims to seek return of their property and thereby mitigate the costs associated with the underlying criminal activity from which they suffer. Crime victims may seek the return of their property in a timely manner in accord with principled decision-making through the operation of the Office of Victims' Rights, the judicial branch of government and other criminal justice agency. Second, Senate Bill 30 aligns with both the letter and spirit of the Alaska Constitution, namely Article 1, Section 24, which mandates that crime victims be treated with dignity, respect, and fairness in a criminal prosecution. Third, Senate Bill 30 is fair in that Senate Bill 30 establishes a legal framework that would consider the institutional perspectives of the Department of Law, law enforcement, the judiciary, the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights within the criminal justice system before property is returned to a crime victim. Senate Bill 30 promotes restorative justice. It moves a crime victim forward in restoring him or her to a position he or she had been in before the crime occurred, so she, he or she may move forward in their lives in a positive and constructive manner. Senate Bill 30 amplifies a crime victim's voice regarding the request for the return of their property while adding clarity and specificity to the crime victim's Alaska constitutional right to be treated with dignity, respect, and fairness. Senate Bill 30 requires decision makers in a criminal prosecution to both hear and consider a crime victim's voice with regard to the return of his or her property. I believe strongly that the administration of the justice is improved when a crime victim's voice is both heard and considered in the criminal justice process. Finally, Senate Bill 30 stands to help crime victims who seek the return of property who may lack the ability to hire a private lawyer or who are unfamiliar with legal process. In essence, Senate Bill 30 allows the expertise of the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights to assist crime victims with getting their property back during what can be often a lengthy criminal prosecution. The OVR, the Office of Victims' Rights, is dedicated, along with the Alaska legislature, to help crime victims. The Office of Victims' Rights seeks to work with others in a spirit of cooperation, collaboration, and respect throughout the criminal justice system. Finally, I have submitted a zero-impact fiscal note to this bill indicating no immediate anticipated cost of this bill to the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights. Thank you for allowing me to enthusiastically testify in support of Senate Bill 30. It is an honor and privilege to do so and serve the Alaska legislature in assisting crime victims in Alaska courts. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any questions for Mr. Kessler. They have the court system online. I don't know if you want to submit yourself to a grilling. I don't hear any. No, nothing for you, Mr. Kessler. We're done.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Court system is here only for questions. If there anybody that wanted them online, and how they're going to fix this. But all right. We will close the public testimony if there's no other. I don't have anybody else signed up. I'll go through formality. I don't see anybody that in the room that was going to testify. I signed up. Is anybody online? We will officially close the public testimony. If we heard the fiscal impact from the affected agency, and we have indeterminate fiscal notes from the Department of Law, as well as zero fiscal notes from Public Safety, and we heard very unambiguously a zero fiscal impact from Office of Victims' Rights, a branch of this agency. Are there any questions on those fiscal notes? Representative Costello, would you like to do the honors?
I guess so, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chair.
Should have given you a heads up.
Sure, a heads up would have been nice. Mr. Chair, I move CS for Senate Bill 30, Second Judiciary, number 27-LS0344/X, with individual committee recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Representative Dugan.
Just for the purposes of a little bit of information, I was curious to know if if people get their property.
I'll object to that so we can.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, object not to you. Object to the motion.
Okay. What I wanted to know was if people get their property back faster, does it affect any claims that they might be able to make about their property itself? Does it affect their insurance claims, or does it affect their ability to make a civil suit or anything like that?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, I would hope if they got it back sooner, they would be able to take care of those issues that are hanging out there for them. And especially with what Representative Thomas said about how they get it back, it's because they're holding on it so long, and it goes along with one of the fiscal notes that are indeterminate. I would hope there'd be less cases in the court because now you have a way for them to be able to go right through, discuss it, and get it back quickly as public safety says they do now.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll withdraw my objection.
Actually, I objected.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I'll withdraw
your objection. Are there any other objections? So Senate Bill 30, a dear friend is departing from committee. We're going to miss you, Senator Dyson. Thank you, Representative Wilson, for presenting. Please, we'll take a brief at ease to sign the fiscal notes and bring Senator Seaton's staff up. He is chairing the...
Senator.
Representative Seaton. Back to order after another actual brief at ease. We have before us House Bill 224. Before we, working with the sponsor, there were some technical changes made. There were drafting errors, I believe. Mr. Co-Chair, can you move the CS so we can object and have Mr. Michelle?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I move for a working document CS for House Bill number 224, Finance, version 27-LS0466/X Gardner 22312.
Object, Mr. Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joe Michelle, staff to Representative Bill Stoltz. The new work draft you have in front of you, there were two changes, one a little bit more lengthy than the first one. The first one is on page 1, line 13. In the original bill, it said under 18 years of age, and it was changed to under 19 years of age.
Is that compliant with our current tobacco statutes?
Through the chair, yes.
Thank you. Consistent, I mean, compliant.
And the second change was added on page 2, line 5. Originally, there was just a number 3, but it has been extended out to provide a list, and prescribed by a healthcare professional, B, given to a person by the person's parent or legal guardian, C, provided by a state-approved tobacco cessation program administered by the Department of Health and Social Services, finally, D, provided by a pharmacist to a person 18 years of age or older without a prescription. And Ms. Shows from Representative Paul Seaton's office will be able to explain exactly why that list was extended.
The disparate age between 19 and 18, that will be explained?
Yes, sir.
Okay, we will just say, line three, we won't get into the definition of the word is. That's the one line that we said. We will, Ms. Show. Shows?
My name is Mary Jane Schell, staff to Representative Seaton. HB 222 came to Representative Seaton's attention last session. 224
for the record.
224, thank you.
It was an old TV series, 224.
HB 224 came to his attention in committee last session, he realized new products containing nicotine.
We'll get to the substance. We're talking about the changes made in the CS. Why don't we? We'll get into the substance of the issue, okay. But we're getting over the technical parts.
The changes. Page 1, line 13, that was 18 years of age. It was under 18 years of age. The reason it was changed, we initially had it as 19. The Department of Health and Social Services had us change it to 18. We did that in judiciary, and then it was very confusing, so it meant that we needed to get it back to 19, because under 19 would allow tobacco cessation programs to be accessible to 18-year-olds or over, right? And that is what the 18-year-olds and over is what the tobacco cessation programs deal with. They give products to those ages.
Well, they have Hess has a lot more influence in judiciary. They tell you what to do down there.
Well, it was.
I'm just teasing you.
And so that was technical. And so, and then there was also a concern that the tobacco cessation programs were not included in the list as far as people who could provide the products, and also the persons 18 years of age now can go to a pharmacist and say, I want to quit smoking, give me a patch. And he doesn't have to go through a program or through a physician. And so those are the changes and why we made those changes.
I'm comfortable. I now understand the disparate age. I'll remove my objection to the CS. Is there any other objection? So the CS is before us. Now spin the story.
Now I can
spin the
story.
Mr. Chair,
I've
got a question.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Just on 3D, and I don't even pretend to understand that I understand what products pharmacists give to people with nicotine, but it seems like you want to be able to allow pharmacists to give somebody over 18 a prescription that might have nicotine in it. Is there any reason why? Would those products only be products to help somebody stop smoking? Is that what those are?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, yes, that is correct. Because 1 and 2 reference what products can be used in this program, and the products that can be used are given to these individuals in number 3. So they have to go through all the procedures that is made for cessation only.
Okay. And then just through the chair.
Okay, Vera.
This isn't a big deal to me, but I suppose some people start illegally smoking younger, and their parents catch them, and they become addicted by them, and they want to go to a pharmacist to get a product before they're 18. Why is if you've got the protection that you can't get it unless a pharmacist gives it to you, do we need the 18 years or older provision in it?
I was approached by the lawyer, Department of Law, and Andrew Harrington, Department of Law, was concerned that now 18-year-olds could go and get it, and the way that this new legislation is written, that they will no longer be able to get it. And so they were concerned that of age
18 years of old, of age or older, could not do that. So that was their premise, was to allow that to happen as an adult. Whereas now, if you're a minor, your parents or legal guardian can give it to you. But if you're 18, they just wanted to clarify that and make sure an 18-year-old being of age could access cessation products.
Just through the chair, if you're 17 and you're trying to get off nicotine, hopefully not too many 17-year-olds are at that point, but can they not get then a pharmacist prescription to help them get off nicotine?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, no, they cannot. The cessation programs, that the way that it works now is they will give literature, but the way this is written, only 18 years of old or older can actually access these products. If they can get their parents to give them the product, but not, or they can go get a physician to give them the product, but not, they can't go up on their own to access it.
Okay, thanks. I don't want to belabor this.
Or you, I guess you can do like you have to go tap somebody on the shoulder. I really need some nicotine cessation. That's probably not going to happen. Representative Fairclough, and then I'm not trying to be frivolous on this.
In your research, did you find any other products that have nicotine that wouldn't be regulated? Is there, I guess I'm thinking energy drinks. The energy drinks have things to make you stay awake. Are there products that we're regulating or we're proposing to regulate that, have you done any research on what has nicotine in it and at what concentration levels?
Show and tell time.
There's nicotine water. What's happening, what brought this to Representative Seaton's attention was that there are what they're called dissolvables. They're nicotine dissolvables. They're not regulated under the Federal and Drug Act. They are being test marketed right now in four or five states, and these products are hand wipes. You can buy you can get hand wipes. These are lozenges and nicotine water. They're also toothpicks, and lozenges, toothpicks, and these are the orbs. So what this bill will address are these products that are coming on the market that a minor cannot just walk up and purchase these. That's the reason for this bill.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I read the information provided in the packet, so I was aware of those types. I was wondering if there's anything else on the market. Have you done research to see if there's a higher percentage inside of beef jerky, as an example? I have no idea. I understand that we're trying to be preemptive before products hit Alaska as far as nicotine, but do they put nicotine in other things that we don't, I don't know, do we know if nicotine is in other
through the chair,
products for consumption?
I do not have that information, but I can research that and get to you with that. I have not done that research. I've stuck with the products that are going to be marketed as non-cessation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Before we get to Representative Costello, where did you get those things?
There is a program in the Virginia Youth Action Group that has they put together a packet and some information, and these were included in that packet.
But you didn't pick those up at a local convenience store. No, they're not. I'm asking seriously. Are these available now? Or you use the word preemptive, so that's
right. Representative Stoltz, these are not available. They're being test marketed in Ohio, Oregon, Indiana, Colorado, and North Carolina. That is their test market right now.
Thank you. Representative Costello.
Thank you. Through the chair, my question just has to do with your decision to include the $300 fine, and if there was a discussion for that number to be higher, to be more of a deterrent. Just curious where that amount came from.
There was discussion about having it the same as selling tobacco products, and it was determined that that would make it onerous for the actual people that are selling the cessation products, and it would create a statutory problem if we just added it to that, so we're adding it in a different area and only making it a $300 fine.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
It's not a $300 fine. It's not less than $300.
Right. Sorry. Yes, thank you.
Representative, not seeing any other hands up.
And then
Representative Edgman.
Perhaps this is time, Chief, but I don't think there's a conspiracy involved if you get two or more of these kids together, do you? Is there? I think we're Bill from last week.
Okay. Yeah, it's late in the afternoon. It's been a long day. any other questions for Ms. Shouse? Welcome, Representative Seaton. You're on the ropes here. We need you to come in and no, your staff is doing just great. We are on the nicotine bill. We're on the fiscal bill, so we'll come to you for closing if there's any. And I only saw two of these questions. We have both zero fiscal notes, so I hope we don't have costs coming back from departments later. We had folks from the Department of Law and Public Health, but they're here for questions only. They're always welcome to pipe in. Representative Guerra.
Chair, for the Department of Law.
Mr. Harrington, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Andy Harrington here in Fairbanks.
Hey, Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Andy, I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of this. Is this a misdemeanor or a felony?
This is a violation. It's a minor offense, so it's not even at the misdemeanor level.
So the store is committing just a violation, not a crime. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, it would be the individual clerk or employee who's making the sale. Who would be, if it's negligently done, is committing the violation. There are currently, well, as you may be aware, under the parallel tobacco sales statute, which is 11.76.100, there are also sanctions that can be imposed upon the store, the licensee, the owner of the tobacco endorsement on their business license, if there's a negligent sale of tobacco to a person under 19. There's no parallel provision at this point for sale of other nicotine products because there's no particular license required or endorsement required on the business license. So this is basically a parallel provision to the minor violation statute for sale of tobacco, tracking it very closely for sale of these other nicotine devices.
Thanks. And through the chair, just finally.
Representative.
Just so Representative Costello isn't misled by my comment before, it says a fine of not less than $300, but if it's only a violation, there's probably a cap that the fine can be at. Is that correct? What's the highest fine that could be levied?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Guerra, the max is $500, so the fine would be between $300 and $500.
Actually, one more question.
I appreciate that information on the record, Representative Guerra.
And do we have the authority as a legislature to allow the fine to be higher than $500? There's no constitutional limitation on how high a fine can be for a violation, is there?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, there would eventually be in that for a minor offense, there is no requirement since the fine is essentially at that level. No requirement for a public defender, no requirement for a jury trial and other procedural protections that would accompany a misdemeanor or a felony. The dividing line between how high the fine might get before the Alaska Supreme Court would find that it is sufficiently severe so that the panoply of criminal protections would apply is not precisely defined. The statute currently for classification of these offenses says that the maximum fine for a violation is $500. It might be constitutionally permissible to go over $500. At some point, you would bump up against that constitutional ceiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I hope we never even have a fine levy. This is a preemption, I hope, preempted. But Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was doing okay there until we got into this. So the question of whether it's a minor violation is a question of the amount of money that can be levied in against it, or is it a separate function which is not really connected to the amount?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, I think the best answer would be it is both. The general criminal statutes classify offenses as felonies, misdemeanors, or minor offenses. Minor offenses include violations, and the maximum fine for a minor offense is $500. There's no jail time available for a minor offense. So the legislature certainly could amend the statute at some point to change the change that maximum fine for a violation or a minor offense. At some point, when the criminal sanction becomes severe enough, due process protections kick in, and that would change the procedures by which these are prosecuted and would have to change the fiscal note as well, obviously.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in order to increase the amount of the fine, I don't know what the cutoff would be, but to an amount that would be substantially in excess of this, we'd have to reclassify the crime as well?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, at some point you would. I would say that you could very easily change this to $400 or even $500, and I don't think there would be any problem with that. Once you go over $500, you might need to make a conforming amendment to another provision of Alaska law, and if you were to take it up in the neighborhood of a couple of $1,000s, then I think there would be a real legal question presented as to whether the criminal due process provisions of our Constitution kick in to require that it be classified as a misdemeanor.
Thank you.
We'd have a whole group of different fiscal notes and a lot more people from other associated agencies sign up to testify. Representative Seaton, before you come in your comments, had we made the motion to move? I forget where we were.
Chair, I have a question for Representative Seaton.
Well, will you hold it for a minute, Mr. Gannon? We adopted the CS. We've been in dialogue. Representative Seaton, to the issue of $300, is that a policy call question? You arrived at that amount. You could have said $50.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Committee, thank you very much. Yes, we did. Part of the purpose of this is right now it's not illegal to distribute nicotine to minors. So someone in a store purchasing, importing, and stocking wouldn't have to keep it behind the counter, would have no responsibility for someone selling that or it getting to minors, because it's perfectly legal to do that. And so part of the purpose of this is to make sure that if someone would bring nicotine as nicotine, not as a tobacco product or tobacco cessation product, into sell, they're going to have to control that. So this is, as you said, Mr. Chairman, a preemptive move. If we get the fine too high and then we have to start getting to public defenders and all those kind of things. We get that due process argument, and to us, what we were looking at was saying, how do we preemptively go in and make sure that we don't have folks getting people addicted to nicotine, which will then later, at some later time, turn probably into a tobacco with all of those problems. And so, yes, the fine was to be...
That was a sweet spot you found?
That was a spot I found.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
On that point, the definition of a person, obviously, is much larger. It includes a business, a corporation, and so forth. And so would the $300 fine under this bill apply towards the individual that may commit this crime as well as the business that commits the crime? Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edgeman, yes, it's a person that sells. So it's not a business tax, and we specifically didn't make it attached to the business license, because then you get into challenges to occupational licensing or to business licenses and those kind of certificates. So it became a much more complex thing with the Department of Commerce once you go into putting a attachment onto a license. And so we felt that this was a good, clean, financially reasonable way for the state to accomplish its goals without trying to, you know, go to misdemeanors or felonies and get in due process arguments. Does that answer your question? This goes to the person that sells tobacco or sells non-tobacco nicotine to a minor.
It does respond to my question, but I'm sure my memory is faulty, but I thought the word person had a much greater definition of law than just a single individual.
Can
we ask the Department of Law that question?
Mr. Harrington, can you, did you hear the question? I bet you want it restated.
I think I heard the question. Let me try to answer it, and if I get it wrong, you can restate it at that point. I do think it's correct that person can encompass a business. I think what we run across is there's kind of a practical limitation here, and that this is only an offense if the product is negligently sold. For the straightforward case where I give or sell a nicotine product to somebody without checking their ID, it's fairly easy to show that I, as an individual, was negligent because I didn't check the ID, or because I didn't I checked the ID but didn't do the subtraction right, or something like that. So I think that it's fairly easy to show if the individual is negligent. As a practical matter, it may be difficult to show that the business was negligent if the business has policies and procedures in place that tell me, as an employee of that business, that I should be checking IDs, and I'm the one who makes the mistake. I anticipate that there would be a practical problem with trying to bring a prosecution against the business itself. But I do agree that it would be possible. If there were a case in which the clerk had never been told that it was not legal to make a sale to a minor, and it could be shown that the business had not put procedures in place, then it is at least theoretically possible that this prosecution could be brought against the business. As a practical matter, I would say that that's unlikely.
That satisfies my question.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Just following along Representative Edgman's questions, I think if businesses are at no risk of liability, they're not going to really care whether, at least some of the businesses that are run by people who aren't socially concerned, those businesses. And I know a lot of businesses are run by people who are socially concerned. But for the businesses that aren't, there's no disincentive for them. There's no incentive for them to train their employees at all, because the employee bears all the liability. They're the one that sells it. They're the one that's going to get in trouble. And you could take the cynical view, what does the business care? And I'm wondering whether we should what the sponsor would think about adding language that would also allow us to fine the business if they negligently allow an employee to sell. A language that sort of tracks the cigarette ban language that holds businesses liable, because unless you're placing an incentive on businesses to train their employees, they really have no skin in the game. So I guess the question would go to the sponsor.
Mr. Seaton.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I guess we found that there was a lot of concern, and if it attached to a business license or a, you know, tobacco license, alcohol, we found that as soon as you started getting into the that aspect of the bill, it became very difficult. And I think that, you know, my perspective is that if the business knows that it's illegal for any of their employees to sell or give nicotine products to minors, that they're going to have to keep them behind the shelf or do something to make sure that that, you know, isn't very easily done. And so I think that we can get to the point we want to get to with making it illegal anyway and having some kind of a fine rather than trying to encompass everything. But it's before the committee, and so the committee has jurisdiction to bill.
Through the chair, follow up.
Representative Guerra.
I certainly understand your concern about not wanting to get involved in business licenses and taking away people's business licenses, and I agree with that. But I am concerned that there is no incentive. I don't see any incentive for a business to train their employees on this, since all of the liability rests on the employee and none of it rests on the business.
And I would just say that right now, you know, we are not one of the test marketed states, and I think that if it's illegal, there people who would be marketing this are going to have a hard time getting businesses to carry something that would be illegal to them to distribute to their target audience. So I think that, you know, it's a matter of perspective of where we want to go, and I think the what we found was a resistance to moving through if it attached to a business license and all was significant enough that it was much better to have a bill in place that says, you know, hey, there's a $300 fine if you if your employees sell these products to someone, and so hopefully the products will never come to Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. So, and I want to channel through Representative Broomberg. This got through him. But that is a... we're trying to make sure this isn't sold in the first place, and I don't want to create a whole new business law body that's going to make it more complicated to pass and to implement when you're trying to hit this thing when it's a larval state right now. But I'm kind of inclined to go with the simpler approach, but anybody can offer any amendment in this committee. I don't think your approach is broke right now. I don't want to fix it till it is, because I hope it's never implemented, quite frankly. It's preemptive in nature. We could get into a whole complicated body of law and look for every single boogeyman behind the door, but there are valid questions to bring up. A pretty simple approach to a problem you hope that doesn't climb into Alaska. For me, it's pretty straightforward. We can do the judiciary work here on. Certainly, there's an amendment process, and we'll address it. Representative Dugan.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, I guess I probably should have made this clearer, but my questions about how much you can charge people for and the rest of that were informational for me rather than an idea that I was going to start pumping this baby up, particularly since we haven't done anything at all yet.
I think the discussion we had about it was revealed with the Department of Law, and I'm glad those questions were asked. Otherwise, Mr. Harrington wouldn't reveal that information. We know the top end of violations, and we did a little bit of. We didn't get too deep into judiciary here, which is good, but we got in enough to be dangerous.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anybody from the public who wishes to testify? Anybody online? Did the person from Public Health wish to testify? It said questions only, but we always ask. Okay, we'll go ahead and close public testimony.
Vice Chair, it's my section. We have 2-0 fiscal notes from the Department of Law and one from the Department of Health and Social Services. You're my wing person here, so we have the 2-0 fiscal notes. What is the will of the committee? Oh, excuse me, are there any amendments? I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bura.
I'll speak to the sponsor, but I'm still concerned that about the comments I made about whether there should be an incentive on the store to train. So, but I'll speak to the sponsor about that afterwards.
All right. Representative Faircliff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The state of Alaska, at least the city of Anchorage, already requires such compliance. Businesses have been closed down based on selling cigarette products in the form of cigarettes to underage people trying to access that product. So I believe all those procedures are in place, and it seems like this would dovetail into that particular training program versus requiring an additional program. They already are mandated to train that. Their business is at risk if they sell to minors cigarette products. I would think that this is a nice preemptive strike, and that they can incorporate that particular conversation in if they need to. I'm hoping that, as Representative Steaton has stated, that we just won't see those products in the state of Alaska, that we make, that we're making our concerns known now in an effort to stop those products from being purchased and sold in Alaska. Certainly that's up to individual businesses. Mr. Chairman, are you ready for a motion to move?
Yeah, I'd just like to, I'm really proud of one of the businesses in my community. They've probably had some financial loss. Alice Mays, which is where I get my gas in Chugiak, they said, we have decided as a business to not sell to anybody under 21. They have taken it upon themselves, and I'm sure they've lost revenue on that, and they don't want to err on the side of giving it to a younger person. And you know, that was a free market decision that was made with probably some penalties to them that they missed revenues. But you got to commend them for it's whether their choice, whether you agree or not, as a business, they made it, and they suffer whatever consequences and whatever promoted goodwill. But Representative Faircliff.
Mr. Chairman, I'd offer to the committee to move the CS for House Bill number 224, Finance 27-LS0466/X-Gardner, date 2/23/2012, attach fiscal notes and individual committee recommendations.
Are there any objections? This bill is moved out of committee. You don't need to go anywhere. Representative Thomas.
When I was 20 years old, federal government gave me free cigarettes, so let's go from there.
That explains it.
We'll stand briefly so we can sign the report and you can prepare for your next bill. Back in order, after another true brief at ease, so we have House Bill 302. Before we start, we have a committee substitute for that bill. Apologize that was just passed out. It's our intent to get those out earlier, I think over the weekend. Well, something broke down, but it is not a major change. Mr. Co-Chair, if you'll move it so we can object and hear the description of the changes.
I move CS for House Bill number 302, Finance, version 27-LS1264/I, Kirsch 22312 is the working document.
And I'll object, actually, this one was more than a few technical changes, I recall. Ms. Schroeder.
For the record, Casey Schroeder Hodge, staff director.
Yeah, I missed that.
Thomas. The CS adds new Section 1 and new Section 2. Section 1 clarifies that for every university program or campus that is submitted to the Pick, Click, Give program, they must pay the $250 application fee. And Section 2 says that the university should apply for the Pick, Click, Give program in a manner prescribed by the department. So they are to apply and they are to pay the application fee.
Okay. I'll object. Representative Thomas, did you want to speak to that?
It was, we don't know if it was unintended oversight or what, and we drafted the bill to somehow the university found a way to not pay the fee, and so all we're trying to do is treat everybody equally, and if you want to be listed, you pay the $250. There is a cost, as we those who remember when we put this bill together to have the help the Department of Revenue with the expenses and the cost of running this. So we just try to put everybody in there and be treated equally with that amendment. For sure.
I'll withdraw my objection. Are there any other objections maintained to the CS? Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the purposes, can I object for the purposes?
Yes. I'll maintain my objection. So.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This says university program or university campus, and I understand university campus pretty well, but program, do we mean like the English department would have to apply separately for
AMSET.
Sorry?
AMSET and AMC, different, there's other programs.
They're probably, I would suspect, Mr. Co-Chair, that there's probably elements of the university that probably have a lot better fundraising success than individual campuses, but so I don't know. This is your amendment.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Do we have any idea what this is going to cost if we do it by program by program?
Everybody's paying this already, and one good example I was thinking is like the in Haynes they have HARP animals. Everybody has animals, and they're one of the primary recipients of this. Nobody falls under one umbrella. Each nonprofit who wants to be recognized pays for that recognition to the Department of Revenue to be listed as a recipient of the Pick, Click, and Give money. So all we're trying to do is treat everybody the same.
That's true. Trying to remember the debate now a year or two ago now, it was they wanted to have some type of a minimal barrier, so you actually had to have something that made you actually be a serious fundraiser, and 250 was the policy decision made. Is that your, Casey, is that your recollection? It was Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As everyone around this table knows, I've been involved in nonprofits for many years and am supportive of the legislation before us. The issue for the university is they've become very creative in their ability to be represented geographically when you look at the Pick, Click, and Give program and under multiple different programs. And so when the drop-down list appears for everyone else to choose from, you always see the University of Alaska in some way when you drop down those menus. And I believe what the chairman is saying is to provide that benefit, they need to pay $250 for each one of those advertising opportunities to solicit funds from Alaskans Permanent Fund Dividend Check. I know that I received multiple solicitations from multiple areas in the university, both in the legislature and at my private email address. So they've done what we asked them to do. They're out there trying to raise funds for the university, and in some way they've figured out how not to pay the $250 like the other smaller nonprofits.
Representative,
I appreciate the explanation. Thank you.
And actually, the real meat of the bill is the audits, but I'll remove my objection. Is there other objection maintained? And the CS is before us. Now we can get the substance of the bill. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and taking up this bill. This was generated because a number of smaller nonprofits, from the first one that I heard from was the Seward Senior Center. They have about a $260,000 budget, and it was going to cost them $15,000 to do an audit. They get about, they had been participating, but they got about $8,000 in contributions, so it's costing them twice as much to go through an audit as it did for what they received. And the question was, what are we receiving for that? And do we need that for someone to be able to donate to a charity, especially since it has to be a 501(c)? And under the program, they have to maintain their 501(c) status, which requires annually to do the IRS 990 form, which is 12 pages of disclosures and financial things. There's a federal audit requirement that kicks in if you have over $500,000 of federal funds to distribute. But the question is, do these nonprofits, whether it's the Juno Arts Council or the Seward Senior Center or Ketchikan Library, I think it was the Library Friends, or there are just multiple places around the state that ran into this problem of, gee, we have to do this expensive audit for receiving donations through Kick. And the problem was that people would call in and say, oh, I can't give to you normally now because you're no longer a nonprofit, because you're not listed on Pick, Click, Give. And so there's been a lot of confusion that if you weren't on Pick, Click, Give, you're no longer a certified nonprofit. And so we looked at several ways, and the easiest way to do this was to just eliminate that requirement that was put on for anybody over $250,000 annual budget had to do an audit and rely on the 990 IRS form, which if your $240,000 budget, that's what is relied on in the program as well. So for equity across the programs, and also to eliminate the confusion that somebody had lost their nonprofit status, we're just eliminating the requirement in Pick, Click, Give that's done. I mean, audits are great. They should be done on an annual basis, on some kind of a basis, to make sure that people are doing them, but they have to submit their 990 forms anyway. So I think for the Pick, Click, Give purposes, the 990 satisfies all the requirements that we need. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Seaton, I'm going to go directly to the public testimony, because there are a couple of people on here I know are pretty smart, and they will probably answer a lot of the questions in advance. And we have Jordan Marshall and Mike Walsh both available. We'll go to Jordan Marshall first. Mr. Marshall, are you still with us?
Can you hear me?
We can, sir.
All right, am I coming through?
Yes. You're coming through, Mr. Marshall. Go ahead and, you know the drill.
Indeed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jordan Marshall, Special Projects Manager for Rasmussen Foundation, R-A-S-M-U-S-O-N Foundation in Anchorage, Alaska. And among the projects I have the pleasure of managing is the Foundation's role in administering the Pick, Click, Give PFD Charitable Contributions Program. Good afternoon. I want to quickly thank the committee for its support of the Pick, Click, Give program and for its willingness to consider ways to improve it. For diving into testimony, I have some good news to report. As of this morning, $1.59 million have been contributed since January 1st of this year by more than 17,000 individual Alaskans, which actually eclipses last year's three-month total as of this morning. So we're on track to hit $2 million in pledges from Alaskans to the 400-plus organizations, plus each and every one of the campuses of the university this year. It's very exciting. I'm here today to talk about the filing fee, not so much the audit. My colleague Mike Walsh of the Forager Group can speak to that. If you don't mind, I would skip straight to the issue of the filing fee.
Go ahead, Mr. Marshall.
Thank you. Every organization that participates pays an annual filing fee, which covers the cost of basic administration of the program. That's everything from vetting the eligibility applications to sending the checks out to the organizations when the dividends and pledges are calculated and distributed. We manage the online donation form and provide technical assistance for the nonprofits wishing to enroll. The only exception to that is currently our friends, the campuses of the University of Alaska system, which are listed annually without filing for eligibility. This CS clarifies that all names listed on the Pick, Click, Give list for PFC charitable contributions have paid the filing fee. As Representative Thomas, the sponsor of the original enabling legislation, noted, it's a simple fairness issue. We're pleased and encouraged and welcoming, of course, of all the campuses on the list, and this just clarifies that they will that pay their share in helping to administer the program. A question from Representative Dugan about programs. Indeed, this would allow for each individual program of each campus to make the selection to pay the filing fee and be listed separately as a potential beneficiary among all the nonprofit organizations that are currently on the list. And, of course, it will be the prerogative of each of those programs and campuses then, just as it is for any and every nonprofit in the state of Alaska, so long as they meet their eligibility requirements, that they would be make that decision to submit an application. That's about all I got to say. We'd be happy to, I'd be happy to answer questions.
We have one right for you right now. Representative Fairclough has a question, Mr. Marshall, and then Edgman.
Thank you. Jordan, thank you for your work on Pick, Click, and Give. Mr. Marshall, can you tell me why other nonprofits couldn't follow the example of the university then and start submitting $250 increments to be listed more often in the rotation of the names that are up on Pick, Click, and Give?
Oh, you know, I think Representative Fairclough through the chair.
No, I like your aha moment there. That was actually kind of cool. Go ahead.
Well, if you add that with your original observation that organizations can pop up several times depending on how their which service offerings they provide, each organization can find itself listed in several different categories depending on the search that an individual conducts when filing to making a pledge donation. So every organization that is available for donations through Pick, Click, Give each year actually only has one record. However, it could be found in numerous ways depending on which search characteristics you apply. So, for example, if I were searching for organizations that were based in Fairbanks, I would find each of the University of Alaska Fairbanks campuses and rural campuses listed. But if I searched for all organizations that provided educational services, I'd find them again, but listed with other organizations that provide that kind of service. So each individual $250 filing fee actually allows an organization into the database once, but so long as they provide multiple types of services, they might be found in different ways.
Mr. Jordan, let me give you an example. I currently work at Hospice of Anchorage, and they have a program there called the Forget-Me-Not program that's specific for children. As I understand it, and I haven't looked at the university when I've written checks for the university programs, I've done it with a personal check versus Pick, Click, and Give. But if we're going to have the University of Alaska Fairbanks listed as a campus, and then we have ANSEP, both those programs may drop down, not as two different entries, not just one. I thought I saw Southeast Campus listed differently than Fairbanks Campus listed differently. And I could be wrong. I just remember when I went to choose the charities that I wanted to donate to on the list this year, that I thought that the university was represented in more than just one form, because I searched just, I believe, in my judicial district and thought I saw multiple drop-downs for the same, the university overall, as well as campuses and then program. So I'm just wondering if we need to limit it, or if I need to direct other nonprofits to start adding programs in. It seems like it would just inflate the number of people asking for programs. So I just like some assurity that it's one program listing and that I don't need to advise the nonprofits that I support that they should be listing programs too.
Representative Faircloth, through the chair, I think, forgive me for not having heard the question the first time clearly. Each campus of the University of Alaska is currently listed. Say, for example, the University of Alaska Anchorage is listed separately. Now, they have a number of campuses underneath that are, for example, the Prince William Sound campus, the Mat-Su campus. Each of those are also listed separately. As for certain programs of those campuses, currently none of those programs, just campuses, are listed in the Pick, Click, Give program. Now, in answer to another angle to the question, there are a number of nonprofits that list a particular program of theirs as their common name. Each organization has an option to be listed as either their official name with the IRS or a common name. So, for example, an organization like Safe Harbor is well known as a different name. Anchor Arms does business as Safe Harbor Inn in Anchorage. So they typically are listed as Safe Harbor. So that's where sometimes a program of a nonprofit will find itself on the Pick, Click, Give list.
Mr. Chairman, I have one final question. When we had this bill before us before, I didn't think that $250 actually covered the full cost of the program, and we were given information, I believe, at that time several years ago that $500 fee was closer to actually covering the costs of the current program. Do you know whether that's true or not, or I can ask the administration about that?
Thank you. Representative Faircloth, through the chair, when we were engaged in the conversation and the legislature made a decision about resetting the filing fee, what we had was a couple of years' worth of administration of the program under our belt, and we could tell how much it cost to carry out the basic administration of the program and reset the fee, estimating how many organizations were currently participating in the program and would essentially recoup their $250 filing fee. So it was a very good guess in setting the fee at $250 so that each organization that was making that much or more through Pick, Click, Give, if they continued to submit an application, would, through that filing fee, end up paying for the cost of administration of the program. To the best of my knowledge, that has proven itself to be an excellent number insofar as the Department of Revenue from the Fund Dividend Division has been able to carry out its work using the filing fees from the organizations that select to participate.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. Marshall? Okay, thank you. And you can hang around in case there's any follow-ups, but given the late hour of the day, probably not. But Mr. Malsh, are you still in Fairbanks?
Yes, can everybody hear me okay?
Loud and clear.
Great. Thank you. Thank you to the Finance Committee for giving me the opportunity to speak on the Pick, Click, and Give bill. Just for the record, my name is Dr. Mike Walsh, W-A-L-S-H, and I am Vice President of the 4-Acre Group, and the spelling on that is F-O-R-A-K-E-R Group. And my testimony today really revolves around the audit requirement itself. We're not taking a position on any particular amount or removal of the audit requirement. I just felt it was important to speak about the overall purpose of the audit requirement as it relates to the Pick, Click, and Give program. I will say that I've really been honored to have been part of the very early stages of developing this program, so it's thrilling to see the progress and to hear Jordan's numbers about today's status is just excellent. The idea in the original bill was really to give Alaskans a couple of things to help them decide where their to talk about the ability of a nonprofit to meet the IRS requirements of mission, fiduciary responsibility, legal responsibility, et cetera. But there really wasn't a way to sort of provide an extra layer of confidence so that an Alaskan making a choice to donate through Pick, Click, Give could feel that an organization on that list was going to be a good steward of his or her donated dollars. And that's really where, you know, that's ultimately the idea behind the audit requirement is that, it's an added level of scrutiny. It really allows for an outside opinion on the finances and general management principles of a nonprofit organization. So, in essence, if I'm making a decision about where to send my dollars, I really want those to go to an organization that I feel confident will spend my dollars well. And that means being good stewards of the dollars, but also spending them in a way that, makes the most of those donated dollars. And really that's, when it comes down to it, that's the initial, or that's the reason behind having that audit requirement. Now, having said that, for a nonprofit that is maybe not taking part in the Pick, Click, Give program, the audit is still a very valuable tool. It's a tool that is valuable internally so that organizations can keep track of their management and financial practices and make adjustments as necessary. But it's also a way to really meet the needs of external funders who are also interested in management practices, that their dollars are going to an organization that will be good stewards. So, you know, overall, just all by itself, apart from the Pick, Click, Give requirement, the audit is really a significant thing, and I think Representative Seaton covered that very well. But for Pick, Click, Give, it was just an added level of really assurance that, you know, among those other qualifications or those other criteria to get on the list of, to be on the Pick, Click, Give list, that Alaskans could really look at that and say, yes, I'm pretty confident that my dollars are going to an organization that will be a good steward. And with that, I'll be thrilled to accept any questions.
I think you've done such a good job, you've snuffed out all inquisitiveness, sir.
Oh, my goodness. Either that or it's late.
Oh, I think it's the former. Okay. So, is there any questions? Is there? Thank you very much, Dr. Walsh, for your testimony. Is there anybody else wishing to testify on the bill? Ms. Bitney, did you wish to make any comments of department's concerns? You sure we can't get you up here? Okay. With that, we'll close public testimony. We have the zero fiscal notes. Representative, Mr. Co-Chair, this is, you're one of the, probably the primary father.
Yes.
Okay. Well, we can have dual parentage on this legislative process, we can. Success has a lot of fathers.
Yes.
Failure is an
order. Yeah. Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move from Committee CS for House Bill Number 302 Finance Version 27-LS1264/I, Kirsch 22312, with accompanying fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
And I will only object to ask if there were any amendments anybody had wished to offer because I missed that step of our approval process. Hearing none. So, Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have an amendment, but I'll work with the sponsor after it moves from committee. It is my understanding, and it is a policy call, whether multiple programs can have, or one program can have multiple donation streams. And I know it's because we restrict at different levels, so there's value to that. I know that if we donated to the University of Alaska as a whole, that it could be used at any individual campus. And if we donate to individual campuses, it can only be used at that campus. And if we further define down where we want to donate, that might be to an individual program, and all of that has value. My question will be, as I've asked Mr. Marshall, is if Hospice of Anchorage, which is a nonprofit that I know about well, or Standing Together Against Rape Star in Anchorage, have individual programs, if they start popping up with all of their programs, it may confuse people. And so I just want to have a brief conversation about the university and allowing them so many different ways to ask the community under different topics or letterheads, per se, of how many times that we want to donate to the University of Alaska system. And all of them are valuable, and people, donors should be able to direct that. But if that's the case, then other nonprofits should be allowed that same opportunity, too. And so if we're okay with the University of Alaska doing that, which I am, then I think other nonprofits need to know that they can, based on a $250 contribution, try to solicit for those individual programs, too. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
They might be channeling that they really seek more BRUs than they have, because that could be something hidden and veiled. There being no objections, the bill with the attached fiscal notes is reported from committee. Please stay around and sign the committee reports. We actually we got through the three bills we intended to move out. That's progress with a very lively public process and rounds of debate. Tomorrow we have two bills, 304, House Bill 304, Alaska Fire Standards Council, and House Bill 254, the Alaska Native Language Council. Both bills receiving their first hearing this committee. And then, as previously mentioned, in the evening we have public testimony on probably the first round of public testimony, I would suspect, depending on how many folks sign up, on HDR 16. With that, we will stand adjourned until tomorrow at 1:30.